So tonight I'm going to give a talk on the Satipatthana Sutta, but not obviously not the entire sutta. In fact, now what I want to talk about is the part of the sutta that I think of sort of like the introduction, where it's before the Buddha starts giving instruction on all the 13 different forms of what we could be mindful of. Because this introduction in and of itself is instruction. It's instruction on how to pay attention to the instructions, sort of thing, is how I think of it. So I think that's interesting. I also want to comment very briefly on the word Satipatthana itself. Sati, sati usually translated as mindfulness. Though I'll talk about alternate translations later on. And Patana is wisdom. So this is the mindfulness wisdom teachings. And even there, is this mindfulness that leads to wisdom, or is this mindfulness and wisdom? These languages, like Pali and Sanskrit, is the same way, leave out things like connectors and stuff like that, and you have to sort of figure them out in a broader context. I personally think it's mindfulness leading to wisdom is what this is about. Anyhow, I want to read the first little tiny bit of the sutta here, and you can get a sense of where I'm headed. Monks, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four Satipatthanas. What are the four? Here, monks, in regard to the body, a monk abides contemplating the body, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent to the world. And then he goes on and repeats that for the other three Satipatthanas. And just that statement, those two sentences, it's like it says an incredible amount about how we want to sort of orient our practice in a sense. And the first part of this I want to talk about is the words direct path, because this is from Anileo's book Satipatthana. This is his PhD thesis on the Satipatthana Sutta. And he goes into great detail about the words direct path, which when I first read this, I thought that was obvious, but he explains that it's somewhat less than so. Anyhow, the qualification of being a direct path occurs in the discourses almost exclusively as an attribute of Satipatthana. Thus, it conveys a considerable degree of emphasis. Such emphasis is indeed warranted, since practice of the direct path is an indispensable requirement for liberation. As a set of verses in the Satipatthana points out, Satipatthana is the direct path for crossing the flood in the past, present, and future times. So this is, he's now referring to a different version of this. This is the main version I'm reading from. There are apparently several other versions of Satipatthana teachings in other forms, in other parts of the sutta. And then he goes on to this, the word direct path. Direct path is a translation of the Pali expression ekayano magga, made up of the parts eka, which is one, ayana, going, and magga, path. So it's like the one direct, one ongoing path. Pali to English is never easy. But then he says this fantastic thing. He says, the commentarial tradition has reserved five alternative explanations for the understanding of this particular expression. So we think, oh well, direct path, we know what that means. But apparently in the commentaries on the sutta, which were written after the suttas were recorded, then people started writing commentaries on them, of course. It was just how philosophers live, right? So, according to them, a path qualified as ekayano could be understood as direct path in the sense of leading straight to a goal. A path to be traveled by oneself alone. So it's the one path that you have to do it by one. As a path taught by the one, being the Buddha is the one, right? As a path that is the only path, or as a path which leads to one goal. So you can see even these are like five somewhat different interpretations of this simple word, right? And this is why there are so many different schools of Buddhism, because everybody has their own take on it. And even within the Theravada world, there are different people who would translate this in different ways. He goes on then to explain that he thinks the direct path, the word direct, is the correct translation. And he's sort of setting up for his whole thesis here. He's saying, this is what this stuff is all about. But what's this a direct path for? Right? So for the purification of beings. So the Buddha's acknowledging right at the very beginning, this is about purity, which is makes people uncomfortable to hear that word, I know. But it's like, can we find a way to purification means getting rid of things that aren't appropriate. Right? You can purify your body by washing it. But he's talking about purification in the broadest sense of the word. For the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation. In other words, all that trouble we have in life, we're going to surmount it. For the disappearance of dukkha and discontent. For acquiring the true method. So this is the method, right? For the realization of nibbana. Realization, enlightenment, however you want to translate it. And so this is the first statement. This is at the very beginning of the suttas. He's making it very clear that this is not about relaxation and things like that. This whole practice, this is what it's about. And which is why I'm putting so much emphasis in this, because I think sometimes if we're not careful, we turn this into something we consume that's sort of cool or the latest, whatever. And that's not the intent of the practice. But then he goes on, when he's talking about these four satipatthanas, right? Here, monks, in regard to the body, a monk abides contemplating the body, diligent, clear knowing, mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. That sentence is packed. This is like he's basically saying, here's how you want to approach the practice. Here's the attitude you should take when you're approaching this practice. And so I want to sort of spend quite a bit of time now sort of unpacking this sentence, because it has a lot going on there. So first of all, he says we should be diligent. In other translations, you also see the word ardent here instead of diligent. Ardent's a little more old-fashioned, perhaps, but I like it because it has this sort of, it is more of a like energy thing going on in ardent. And diligent is sort of like I'm paying a lot of attention, but ardent has an extra sort of flavor. I actually looked up ardent in the dictionary. Balance and sustained effort, enthusiastic, passionate, fervent, avid. These are all synonyms, right? So how do we? And what the Buddha is saying is we have to have ardency. When we're going to practice, we have to have ardency. How do we do this? Where do we find our ardency, right? There's a variety of interesting places where we can look for this. One of them, oh my God, is in this book I forgot to grab. No, I'll read from this book. This is the Majjhima Nikaya, and there's a really interesting note here, where the Buddha is talking about the preciousness of having a human body, the preciousness of having the ability to practice in the first place. And there's this wonderful verse. This is in Sutta 129 in the Majjhima Nikaya, verse 24. Suppose a man threw into the sea a yoke with one hole in it, and the east wind carried it to the west, and the west wind carried it to the east, and the north wind carried it to the south, and the south wind carried it to the north. So this yoke, right, which is like what you yoke oxen with, right? So it's got a big hole in the middle. It's floating around in the ocean and being blown all over the place. Suppose there were a blind turtle that came up once at the end of each century. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Would the blind turtle put his neck into that yoke with the one hole in it? He might, venerable sir, sometime or other at the end of a long period. So he's saying, this is how difficult it is to get a human birth. This is obviously hyperbole, right? But it's like he's pointing to how precious it is that we have the opportunity to practice, that we actually have a human body. Just that in and of itself should give us some ardency, right? But here's another thing, and this is from Joseph Goldstein's book Mindfulness, and he's actually quoting someone named Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Ask yourself how many of the billions of inhabitants of this planet have any idea how rare it is to have been born as a human being, which I was just talking about. How many of those who understand the rarity of human birth ever think of using this chance to practice the Dharma? How many of those who think of practice actually do? How many of those who start continue? But once you see the unique opportunity that human life can bring, you will definitely direct all your energy into reaping its true worth by putting the Dhamma into practice. He's pointing to, I mean, I like to think of this as like, boy, am I ever lucky. that I have a body, that I somehow encountered the Dhamma. Someone gave me a book and said, read this book. I mean, it was totally, like that. How do we find this practice? And then we decide we want to do something about it. And then we continue to practice. And saying it's rare doesn't mean, I don't want to like sort of go around patting ourselves on the back saying, aren't we so wonderful? It's more like, aren't we lucky? Isn't it amazing that we have this ability and we've somehow found the time and the energy to actually do this? To actually come here on a Thursday night and share the Dhamma together. This is not something, quote, normal. Everybody's, watching the hockey game or the baseball game or whatever they're doing, dancing with the stars. I don't know. I've never, is that still a TV show? I don't know. I've never seen it, so. But it's like he's pointing to this is a source of how we become ardent. Just this thought of how fortunate we are to be able to do what we're doing here right now and continue to do it throughout our life. Then there's another aspect to this, and this is another way we can sort of build up our ardency, I suppose you might say. This is once again Joseph Goldstein. We can also strengthen the quality of ardor by reflecting on the transiency of all phenomena. Look at all the things we become attached to, whether they are people or possessions or feelings or conditions of the body. Nothing we have, no one in our lives, and no state of mind is exempt from change. Nothing at all can prevent the universal process of birth, growth, decay, and death. When we don't deeply understand the truth of impermanence, we devote ourselves, our lives, and even our meditation practice to seeking and wanting other people, possessions, and experiences. I like his emphasis, even our meditation practice. This is what we can turn our practice into. It's like, oh, this is going to be so cool, and I find out more and go deeper. And we turn it into like wanting something. It's just now, it's such a holy desire, it must be okay, right? But it's still, that's all it is. We get caught up in all the appearances of the illusory world, the round of birth and death, and solidify our sense of self in the process. There is no peace. So this idea of understanding impermanence, this is also the essence, I think, of the First Noble Truth. This is what the First Noble Truth starts with, at least. It's like we have to see really clearly how impermanent everything, including this body, this body-mind, is. Because when we see its impermanence, then we realize that who knows when I'll have a chance to practice next week or next month or next year. We don't know. Things change just like that all the time. And so that's another source of our ardency, this idea that everything, including me, and my ability to practice right now, the life I have right now, the opportunity I have right now, is all impermanent. So take advantage of what's here now. And then there's one other way we can establish ardency, and this is something Joseph suggests, but I find these two verses in the Dhammapada. This is the opening two verses in the Dhammapada. So the Dhammapada is this collection of pithy philosophical aphorisms, I suppose you might, for lack of a better term. It's quite poetic. And this particular translation I have is a more recent translation, and it's actually formatted in poetic format. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a corrupted heart, then suffering follows you as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you like a shadow that never leaves. What I love about this, other than that he's pointing to the truth, you know, it's like we have to start by looking at our heart. Where are we coming from? And make sure that it's pure. This is this practice of purification. Or at least make sure we're moving towards purification, more frequently acting in a pure way, more frequently acting from a place of virtue. And this brings ardency to our lives as well, because this is not easy, right? But I love the images, because you'll see this all through the Buddha's teachings. You know, if your heart is corrupted, right, it's like, and then suffering follows you as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. So this is like, this is an image that everybody in the Buddha's time would understand immediately. Because that was, actually in many places in Thailand and Burma still is, the main mode of transportation is ox cart. And then, the other image for when you're acting with a calm, bright heart, it's like a shadow that never leaves you. Well, that's once again, everybody knows when they walk, there's shadows there. It's like, sure enough, no matter, I mean, whether it's following you or preceding you, but it's right there, it's all around you all the time. It's just always there. Which, once again, an image for it's something that's solid and real. So that's ardent, the first of these qualities he talked about. Remember, there was ardent, clear knowing, mindful, and free from desires and discontent. These were the four qualities we have to have, the four things we have to take and apply to everything we do as we practice the Satipatthana Sutta, as we practice the Buddhist teachings. So the next one was clear knowing. Clear knowing, you hear this phrase. I think other words might be clear comprehension or fully aware. And this is like really seeing things as they are. That's another way it's often said, right? Really understanding that we have to look very closely and really see things as they really are, not through some lens, not through some view, not through some coloring of the mind, but actually see things as they really are. And once again, there's something from the sutta I want to talk about here. This is from sutta number 31, and I'm gonna get the right verses here. So here in this sutta, the Buddha is talking about how these three monks who hang out together in the forest practice. And he starts off with, how do you practice in terms of your daily life practice with, getting on with each other? Just daily life. And the monk answers, "Venerable sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life." That's an interesting thing to reflect on. The importance of Sangha and how lucky we are to have other people to practice with, to gather with and share the teachings. "I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards them, those venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately." I love the openly and privately. He's saying sometimes it's obvious, and sometimes I'm just doing it because I know it's the right thing to do. Doesn't have to make a big deal about it. No one even has to know I'm doing it. "I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, venerable sir, but one in mind. That is how, venerable sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." I love that phrase too. Viewing each other with kindly eyes. Then the Buddha says, "I hope you abide diligent, ardent, and resolute." Oh, here's those words again. "Venerable sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food," so that they would, as part of the tradition, the monastics couldn't grow food, couldn't store food. They had to go every day to the village nearby and walk through the village with eyes downcast, holding their bowl, and whatever food went in the bowl, that's what they ate that day. So that's the setting here. For whoever returns first from the village on foods prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse buckets in its place. So the domestic duties, right? Whichever has returns last eats any food left over if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there is no greenery or drops it into water where there is no life. So it disposes of it in a healthy way. He puts away the seeds and the water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low, or takes them care of them, if they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. But every 5 days we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. That is how we abide, a diligent, ardent, and resolute. This is like a wonderful description of leading this really simple, cooperative life. Leading a life where you're really connected to other people and share in the responsibilities of keeping it together and on the day-to-day basis. But at the same time, they're doing it from the point of view of clearly knowing how skillful this is to act this way, organize things by hand signals so they don't have to speak. By not formally taking turns to saying, well, it's your turn to do this or that. Well, I got here last, therefore I'll take care of this stuff. As simple as that. So it's like it's a different attitude towards taking care of things in the world, essentially. Joseph Goldstein, of course, has something to say this as well, put this as well. And he's talking about another sense of clearly knowing, and that's understanding clearly the motivation behind how we speak and act. What's the motivation? I mean, clearly the motivation, how these three guys in the forest spoke and acted together, was everything they were doing was towards keeping things simple to further their practice. Joseph points at something else here. Awareness of motivation plays a central role in the path of liberation. As we settle into a growing awareness of ourselves, we begin to realize that our practice is not for ourselves alone, but can be for the benefit and happiness of all beings. How does our practice benefit others? How does feeling our breath or taking a mindful step help anyone else? It happens in several ways. The more we understand our own mind, the more we understand everyone else. We increasingly feel the commonality of our human condition and what creates suffering and how we can be free. Our practice also benefits others through the transformation of how we are in the world. If we're more accepting, more peaceful, less judgmental, less selfish, then the whole world is that much more loving and peaceful, that much less judgmental and selfish. Our mind body is a vibrating, resonating energy system. Of necessity, we are affects well, how we are affects everyone around us. On a boat in the middle of a great storm, one wise, calm person can bring everyone to safety. World is like that boat, tossed about by storms of greed and hatred and fear. Can we be one of those people who help keep it safe? Can we be one of those people that help keep it safe? This is clearly knowing why we practice. This practice sometimes gets sort of dissed into like, oh, that's just like because you're doing this for yourself and you're heading towards enlightenment and it's all about you. But the more we move in that direction, the more we move towards deeper purification, the more that energy goes out into the world and everyone around us. And that's a great gift that the world really needs, that we can give the world. And I'm not, once again, not saying this in like, oh, aren't we wonderful and great? That's just the truth. This is the truth of what this practice does. And you feel it. I've been around one of my teachers in particular. I'd be in the same room with him. I'd go be going in to do a practice meeting. And just being in the same room with him, it was almost like, well, I don't really have to say anything. I just gotta hang out with him in this great space. And not, but I was like, I'm a very verbal person, so I don't, then I'd start talking anyway. But it was always like just walking into the room and sitting there and smiling at him would be like, everything's okay. And I saw him many times in various teaching situations where he would answer a question or say just a few words to someone about something, and the whole room would change. Like the whole room would just get blasted with this energy, this calm, still, focused, peaceful energy. It's a really powerful thing. Okay. So that's clearly knowing. Then we go on to mindfulness. Mindfulness is the translation of sati, right? This is, but another translation of mindful, of sati, is remembering. And it's like, oh yeah, when I'm practicing, that's really all I'm doing, in a sense. I keep having to remember that I'm practicing, because I'm sitting there, I'm watching my breath, and I'm paying attention to my body and noticing my mind states and whatever I'm doing. And then, of course, blah, 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 my mind goes off in some interesting direction, or uninteresting direction, or totally foolish direction for that matter. And I'm not being paying attention anymore. I'm not being mindful. And then I remember, oh, wait, I'm sitting here, I'm meditating, pay attention. It's that remembering, that constant remembering over and over and over again to start again. That's the essence of the practice. Just being able to remember to start again. Whether it's moment to moment in a particular sitting practice or walking practice or in life for that matter. Or, sometimes we sort of have, we drift away from the practice and we get distracted by other stuff and we don't. Our practice isn't there for a while. And then we remember, oh yeah, things seem to go much better when I practice. And then we get back and we get back into the rhythm of the practice again, whether it's, as I say, both formally and informally, just in the world. It's also, and this is something I come across that sort of surprised me, but it's an interesting way to think about it. Mindfulness is protective. Just the act of being mindful in our daily lives protects us. Because often, if we're not careful and we're not being mindful, something arises, as things always do, and we react unmindfully, unskillfully, then all hell breaks loose, right? And it might be like two moments of hell, or it might be the next 3 days because I said or did something really unskillful, or who knows? But it's like just not being mindful in our daily lives, in our just going out there in the world, acting in the world as householders like we all do. It's when we're not mindful that we get ourselves into trouble and cause our own suffering and the suffering of others. So being mindful protects us from that arising. It just we don't have to worry about it because mindfulness there like a fence. This is an image often used. Mindfulness is like a fence, and our mind is sort of like an animal, that's kept inside a compound, right? And so you got to have you can't have the fence can't be too tight. This is an image I love. And it can't be a fence, so they can't if the animal's all like penned up and squashed, then it's going to be really unhappy and a grumpy animal. It's not going to be very healthy either. But if the fence is too big, if the you give the give a cow 300 acres to wander around, well, it's going to wander around, right? So, but you want to keep so you want to have the fence enough that the animal has room to move around and stay healthy, but not so big that it just wanders off, which is well. So that's like we have to where mindfulness is like this fence we build around ourselves to keep us from wandering too far off into who knows what. Then the last of these is free from desires and discontent. Ah, here we are. We got past the first noble truth. Now we're on the second. free from desire and discontent. Desire and discontent sort of go together because often we have desires that aren't satisfied and then we're discontented. So this is, and that discontent, that's a nice polite word for suffering. Ours and other people's. Because, when we're discontented, we then turn into grumpy people who make other people discontented. Just that's human nature in some sense. But I want to read something else from Joseph here. And he's talking about the power of concentration as part of the mind, the process of mindfulness. And how important this is. The strengthening of concentration comes through the continuity of mindfulness. So, the more we're mindful, both in our formal practice and in our lives, it's that continuity of mindfulness that deepens our concentration. We can practice this continuity in two ways. The first way is cultivating a direct awareness of a single object. We practice keeping the mind steady on the breath, the movement of a step, a sound. So this is formal concentration practice, where we choose one simple object. And many meditation methods other than the ones the Buddha taught, anything to do with mantra practice or visualization practice, they're very much in this mode of concentration. The second way develops a more choiceless awareness. Here we are cultivating one pointedness of mind on changing objects. This is called momentary samadhi, momentary concentration. Our practice is a skillful interweaving of these two approaches. We can focus on a single object when the mind is sluggish or distracted in order to develop internal joy and serenity. And when the mind is again collected, we can open to an undirected, choiceless mode of awareness. After some time, we get a very intuitive feel for which is appropriate at any given time. This is really interesting and important that we understand this, that there's not like just this one way of practice. When there's these, and there's like between this just one pointedness and totally open. There's things like anchored awareness, where we're aware, but we have an anchor we keep going back to. There's, sort of semi-focus where I have breath, but I also have sound and use, two or three senses, hearing, and taste and breath are, and I let that be my focus. So it's a little wider. The fence is a little bigger. Going back to my analogy. So it's not just one or the other. There's these gradations in between as well. But the skill that we need to learn, and we learn over time, is when to go one direction or the other, when to shift more towards this open awareness, and when to, as he says, oh, my mind's really distracted and jumbled. I think I'm going to really do something simple and concentrated. When I began, and Joseph goes on, when I first began meditation practice, I had very little concentration. I enjoyed thinking and would spend much of the time lost in reverie. Over the years, I found one particular practice that helped a lot in strengthening this concentration factor. Both in formal walking meditation and also in just walking about, I changed the focus of my attention from simply knowing I was stepping to feeling more precisely the particular sensations of each step, lightness, heaviness, pressure, stiffness, and so on. This is a way of practicing the embodied presence of practice. So he's saying we start to sort of find ways where we can refine the practice by broadening it a little bit. So, usually when we first teach walking practice, we say just note the step. That's plenty. And then he's saying, but now pay attention to the quality. Just like when we're talking about breath, paying attention to the quality of breath. This is how we refine our practice. And once again, this is something we learn to do over time. This is where the skillfulness in practice arises. But then Joseph goes on. One of the great gifts of deepening concentration is that it helps keep our various mental hindrances at bay. It's like building a fence to keep out unwanted intruders. Here's the other side of the fence, right? By temporarily dampening the force of lust and craving, aversion and restlessness, it opens us to the more refined pleasures of the mind. This in turn gives us impetus to develop concentration even more. This is really true. When we start to really become more concentrated, we start to the sensation of it, in a sense. Sensation isn't maybe the right word. The vibe of it is really powerful, and it feels great. It's very pleasant. The danger, of course, is then we just want to meditate to get all this pleasant feeling, but it's like it's also, as he says, it encourages us. This in turn gives us impetus to develop concentration even more. Over time, we see the default level of concentration increase in our minds, which changes how we feel and how we are in the world. We create an inner environment of peace. Although concentration is not the final goal of the practice, still it plays an essential role on the path of awakening. The Buddha emphasized this when he said that respect for concentration is one of the things that leads to longevity of the Dhamma, to its non-decay and non-disappearance. So respect for concentration is what's kept the Dhamma alive for 2,500 years. Interesting thought. This is an important statement for the transmission of Dhamma to the West. We would like everything to be instant, even enlightenment, and we often don't want to put in the time or effort to develop and deepen our concentration. But as concentration gets stronger in our daily lives, it helps us find that place where we increasingly abide free of desires and discontent in regard to the world. And this peaceful composure becomes the basis for greater happiness and freedom. So he's pointing to this last thing, we're free from desires and discontent. It's our deepening concentration that brings that about. Because as we can concentrate more and just pay attention to what's actually here right now, we're not always going out wanting something more and then being unhappy that we don't get it. Or being unhappy that we get something we really don't like, for that matter. I wanted this and I got that instead. Discontent. And he's saying concentration is one of the keys to being able to live a life free from desires and discontent. It's an interesting thing to think of, because we don't really think of concentration in that way. We sort of think of concentration as some sort of mental serious practice, which it is, but it's also pointing to the importance of it in this sense of purification, this pure, this path of purification that we're all on. It's what helps leads us to more purification. So I have one last thing here, and this is a Mary Oliver poem I really love. Right. And he's, in a sense, she's talking about what Joseph was just talking about in her beautiful poetic form. It's called Snow Geese. Oh, to love what is lovely and will not last. What a task to ask of anything or anyone. Yet it is ours, and not by the century or the year, but by the hours. One day, one fall day, I heard above me, and above the sting of the wind, a sound I did not know, and my look shot upward. It was a flock of snow geese, winging it faster than the ones we usually see, and being the color of snow, catching the sun, so they were, in part at least, golden. I held my breath, as we do sometimes to stop time, when something wonderful has touched us, as with a match which is lit and bright, but does not hurt in the common way, but delightfully, as if the light were the most serious thing you ever felt. The geese flew on. I've never seen them again. Maybe I will someday, somewhere. Maybe I won't. It doesn't matter. What matters is that when I saw them as through the veil, secretly, joyfully, clearly. Clear knowing. Actually, just taking it in and understanding. I love this. Like, doesn't, if I see them ever again, it doesn't matter. Because there's that moment where she saw them perfectly clearly, her heart wide open. So that's what I have to say tonight. And I just want to emphasize what I'm trying to point out here is that, we can all just sit there and pay attention to our breath. That's not difficult, right? But it's whether we have the right attitude towards what we're doing. That's what the Buddha was talking about. Before he talked about mindfulness of breath, which comes next after what I was reading, before he talked about that, he said, but make sure you have the right attitude to this practice. Make sure you understand what it's really all about. And take that to heart. Be ardent, be mindful, see things really clearly as for what they really are, and learn to be free from desires and discontent. And then from that place, go practice and pay attention to the breath. And all of a sudden, the breath becomes this incredibly fascinating, interesting thing, as opposed to just, oh, there's another breath, which is where it's easy to end up with practice. So I hope that's of some use.